Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
We maintain the peace through our strength. Weakness only invites aggression.
Trust but verify.
Well, I've said it before and I'll say it again. America's best days are yet to come.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Welcome to the Reaganism Podcast, where we explore where the Reagan movement lives today. This episode of the podcast features a conversation between two former U.S. Secretaries of Defense, Leon Panetta and Jim Mattis. The discussion was moderated by Courtney Kuby, National Security and Military Correspondent at NBC News. The conversation took place on December 7, 2019, at the Reagan National Defense Forum, the country's biggest national security conference. This panel examined the role freedom and democracy should play in our defense policy and discussed questions like, are American values a strategic asset? And if so, how can the United States more effectively utilize our values to compete? How should we approach partners who may not share our principles? To what extent should we seek to promote democratic movements and institutions abroad? Thanks for listening, and visit ReaganInstitute.org to learn more about the National Defense Forum.
What a day this has been. Just tremendous conversation all day long. My name is Courtney Kuby. I cover the Pentagon and national security issues for NBC News. And I want to do some admin first. To the audience in the room and watching wherever you are, you can submit your questions via the RNDF app and on Twitter using the hashtag RNDF. So thank you, everyone in the audience, for being here. It's not lost on us that we are the closing panel before the final session, and that we're one of the few things standing between you and dinner and an open bar. So I think that we have the two perfect people up here to make the 45 minutes fly by. We have former Secretary of Defense and retired four-star Marine General Jim Mattis, AKA Chaos, and former Congressman, former White House Chief of Staff, former Director of the CIA, former OMB Director, former Secretary of Defense, turned winemaker. Yeah. Leon Panetta. Mr. Secretaries, welcome. Thank you both for being here, and thank you for agreeing to let me moderate this panel. I was a little surprised you both agreed to me being the moderator tonight, so we'll see how you feel about that decision in about an hour.
I'm just kidding. We were surprised.
Yeah. It's all right. It's going to be fun. Okay, so the topic tonight is From Syria to China, the Role of Freedom and Democracy in Defense Policy. And the Reagan survey actually had a question, John Carl touched on it this morning, that dealt specifically with this, and I want to start out with. The survey question said, how likely are you to support the use of the U.S. military in several situations? And two that had overwhelming support, more than 76% each, were people said they would support the use of the U.S. military to prevent human rights violations in other countries, and also U.S. military intervention to defend freedom in other countries. Mm-hmm. The reason this stood out to me is, you know, this is a country that elected President Donald Trump on an America First platform. So those numbers surprised me. I'd like to get your reaction. Did they surprise you as well? Secretary?
Who do you want to go first?
I actually, I don't know. We'll go with Secretary Mattis.
I'll yield to Jim.
Yeah.
It doesn't surprise me at all. I think there's deeply embedded in our body politic and our people a sense of pride in what we represent. But more important, I think that we have a sense of I would almost call it defense of those freedoms and democracy and all, because we do recognize since the earliest days of our republic that we are an example, we are an experiment, we are a great big test of whether or not a government of the people, by the people, and for the people can long exist. And there's not some divine right to it. And every generation has committed to it, and after this many years, I'm not surprised at all, Courtney, about that.
You know, the United States is the strongest military power on the face of the earth. But the reason that we exercise leadership around the world and people respect the United States is because of our values and who we are. And our values relate to our freedoms, our liberties, our respect for human rights, our respect for decency, our respect for the ability of people to be able to govern themselves and make decisions about governing themselves. So it's been critical, I think, to the very foundation of United States leadership in the world that we go out into the world to try to defend the values that we think are important for every society.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned human rights. One country that has a poor human rights record is Iran. And we've seen a very grisly demonstration of that just in the last few days with the protests. 1,000 people have been killed. What is the U.S. policy on Iran? Maximum pressure is what we hear a lot about. Do you believe that's working?
Well, look, Iran, without question, is a country that represents a threat. It's one of those threats we are dealing with in a very dangerous world. And they're a threat to regional stability in the Middle East. They support terrorism. They make a point of going after those that try to advance the freedom and liberty that we care about. Iran is a dangerous country and an adversary. I did not, even though I think I had serious concerns about the deal that was made with regards to the nuclear agreement, did not think it was the best deal in the world, but because it was being implemented with regards to trying to restrain their nuclear development, and because we had worked with other allies to develop that approach, I thought it was something that was working and that gave us the opportunity to then push additional agenda items with them. Pulling back on that agreement, and I understand the administration's concern. They've always were concerned about the agreement. But the hope was that it would ultimately lead to some kind of negotiation with Iran. And the problem we have today is that what it has led to is Iran continuing not only to destabilize, but to continue to conduct attacks of various kinds on shipping, and obviously the most sophisticated attack was on Aramco oil using drones. That was a very sophisticated attack. And so it's becoming increasingly dangerous. And I understand, you know, that the sanctions are putting a lot of pressure on their economy. I think part of these protests is the result of that. They are, without question, an authoritarian regime. They're going to deal with protests in the way they did, by shooting people, innocent people. So bottom line is they are dangerous. We need to try to get them to the negotiating table. I don't think what we're doing now is working very effectively to get that done. I would recommend that we continue to work very closely with the other countries that we negotiated the agreement with to try to continue to put pressure on them. As we speak, the European countries are saying because they are now enriching nuclear fuel, because they are developing long-range missiles, that there's a chance they themselves may implement sanctions. I think this is a good time for the United States to get back with them to put pressure on Iran.
Secretary Mattis, do you think that the maximum pressure campaign is working? And I'm curious about JCPOA. Do you think that the U.S. withdrawing from JCPOA, what was the national security impact? Did that make America safer?
Well, I think it's too early to tell on that in that regard, but I would agree with Secretary Panetta's 4 points. I would only add that besides working with the nations that we worked with on the JCPOA, we expand that because there are other nations very concerned and we need to bring them in. The challenge we face, I think, is that we're dealing with a revolutionary regime and we're trying to deal with it as if it's a nation state. Why is that a problem? Because the leaders who have the power are basically unreachable, and the people who are reachable don't have the power because you're working with a revolutionary regime. And what that means is if you start dealing with them, you've also got the internal dynamics there where you can be dealing with people who really are trying to deal with you in good faith, but meanwhile, behind the scenes, something completely different is going on. And remember, there's five threats out of Iran. The nuclear threat was, for a while, under the JCPOA, and I did not believe we should withdraw from it, although I did not like it when we signed it, but it was working. There's the nuclear threat, the latent nuclear weapons program, not nuclear program, but nuclear weapons. Then there's the cyber threat, and they've cost hundreds of millions of dollars to other nations. There's the ballistic missile threat, and their ballistic missiles are a threat all through the region and soon beyond, probably. Then you've got the maritime threat, and the maritime threat, you've seen it actually manifest there in the Straits. And the last one, of course, is the proxies, the surrogates, and the terrorism threat that the Secretary quite rightly pointed out is destabilizing the region. And so when you put all that together, we drove them to the negotiating table on one, but we left the other four unremarked. Well, there's going to be a problem if you live close to a country that has those four left untouched. So we can't even deal with the nuclear threat alone and think that somehow we're going to neuter this problem. It's going to take allies and partners, as almost every problem we face in the world takes allies and partners. And the more time we put into bringing allies and partners on board, which is the way in those days Secretary Clinton drove the regime to negotiate on the nuclear weapons program. They didn't want to. She drove them to it with international economic sanctions. Unilateral don't work. We've got to do this in concert with others.
I'll ask this to both of you. In June, Iran shot down a drone. You mentioned the maritime threat, and that was a time where the tensions were really high between the U.S. and Iran. President Trump went right up to the edge of a strike in Iran and then pulled it back, citing some civilian casualties. But the U.S. did respond with a cyber attack that was then put out into the press. Do you see that as sort of the future of how the U.S. may start responding to some of these threats from Iran, with not just cyber, but what was pretty clearly a heavy IO campaign in the aftermath to make sure Iran knew that the U.S. was behind it?
I think when you deal with these kinds of issues, these are threats to international stability, to international peace, to international commerce. When you deal with these kinds of things, what you've got to do is broaden the competitive space. There's no need to go tit for tat, or they did this, so we do that. You broaden it much, much more in, I would say, a compelling way. You use economics, you use diplomacy, you use information war, where you're beaming and twittering in things right to their young people. We know their young people aren't buying the clerical regimes, but what they stand for. So let's broaden the competitive space and try to do this in a way that forces them, without putting them into, I would call, a box where they have to lash out militarily, that forces them out of their own self-interest to turn back around and knock it off. I think it's too often we sell ourselves short on just how many different ways we can address it. What would happen, for example, if we offered 10,000 scholarships a year to 10,000 boys and girls from Iran to come to our schools or British or Canadian schools for a year of education? I mean, they'd have a heck of a time turning their kids off from getting a hold of that somehow. There's other ways we can do this without getting locked into some narrow-minded approach. Secretary?
I think in dealing with Iran, in dealing with North Korea, in dealing with China, and dealing with Russia, and dealing with our adversaries, that it's incumbent that we deal with them from strength. And if they don't understand that we are willing to exercise that strength, we have a hell of a time trying to get them to try to abide by the kind of international standards that we would like them to abide by. On Iran, and I'll never forget this, Jim was CENTCOM commander. We had, the Iranians had fighter planes that took shots at one of our drones. And it, similar to what happened recently. And at the time, I said, what do we do about this? And what we recommended was that when we send up drones, we scramble our fighter planes to accompany those drones. And if indeed they try to go after those drones, that we're prepared to shoot at them, we're prepared to fire. And we sent that message to the Iranians. They didn't do that again. So I think it's important, I believe you have to obviously exercise it with careful discretion and with the knowledge that if you're going to use that kind of approach, that it has to be done carefully and deliberately. And there are other ways to obviously try to reach out to do that. But make no mistake about it, with this regime in Iran, there's only one thing they really understand, is when we hit them for when they try to take attacks on us.
So you think that the U.S. should have responded kinetically to the drone shootdown in June?
I think there should have been additional steps taken to make clear that we're not going to allow that to happen. I don't mind the use of cyber. I don't mind some of the other uses of other things. But I think it is very important to make clear to them that that is not acceptable behavior on their part, and we are going to deal with it.
The time where the fighter jets targeted the U.S. drone, you wrote about that in your book, Call Sign Chaos, as one of the times that you thought that the U.S. should have responded more forcefully to Iran, the other time being the 2011 attempt on Adel al-Jubeir's life, I believe. Do you, Secretary Mattis, do you agree? Do you think that 2012 response was strong enough by the U.S.?
Courtney, I wrote Chaos. He wrote the Worthy Fights.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he did write about it in his book. You're right.
Did I mix up your books?
Yeah.
Oh.
No problem.
You didn't read, didn't you? Sorry.
No problem.
I did write about it.
You didn't write about it in your book as well, Secretary Mattis?
Yeah. And I gave him credit for basically kicking our ass.
Well, do you, Secretary Mattis, do you think that the U.S. should have responded kinetically in June?
I would just tell you that we cannot allow people to get away with something like that. Now, I don't want to criticize someone who's in the bullpen there and having to deal with it, but I would say that in this world, you don't make false threats. You just don't do it. As Secretary Panetta pointed out, this is an imperfect world. There are some people who don't understand anything but the club. I'd like to tell you that Nirvana is going to break out sometime soon, but until human nature does, we're going to have to deal with something like this and do it authoritatively. When you don't do that, when you make false threats, and I don't care who did, whether it's the red line in Syria or anything else, our adversaries start doubting the political will. And political will, the unity of the country, the unity of our allies, is worth 10 battleships to us in a fight. It's not just about what military capability we have. They have to know that we're united, there are things we stand for, and there are things we will not stand for, and one of them is going after our people or our allies in that way. So we have to make that very clear. And how we do it, there's 100 ways to do it. And there's a couple that you don't want to do.
Another place that the U.S. focuses on a maximum pressure campaign is North Korea. Do you think that the U.S. is at the end of the diplomatic process with North Korea at this point? And what's next?
Well, I hope that isn't the case. But I think we have to learn from what we've just been through these last few years and not repeat the same mistake. I think it was important to try to break through and try to develop communication at a high level. I think that was an important step to take. And I think it is important for the president to engage. But I also think it's important when the president's going to engage that you better damn well prepare the president for what needs to be laid out in terms of those negotiations. And I got the impression that the preparation for those summits in terms of the diplomatic preparation. What steps are we going to require? What are we going to ask them to do when it comes to denuclearization? What are we prepared to do? All of that has to be thought out and prepared. For the president, if the president of the United States is going to sit down with another leader, he better damn well be prepared in terms of what are the issues involved and what do we have to agree on so that you get something accomplished. Summitry, where you kind of shake hands, you know, and there's confetti and balloons, is fine. But it has to be backed up by a substantive agreement as to where you're going to go. And I think that step was never kind of, either it was never taken or there wasn't any kind of sense with North Korea as to what steps needed to be taken. So, you know, the summitry to a large extent has not worked. If we're going to engage, it would seem to me it makes sense to turn to our diplomats, turn to a team that is going to sit down with the North Koreans and try to determine whether there is a serious opportunity here to try to arrive at some consensus. And there has to be preparation, there has to be work done, there has to be a sense that, you know, this country understands what's at stake and what we're going to be asking for, and the president has to allow that to happen. Yes, we've made some progress in trying to restrain what happens in North Korea, but I think North Korea today represents every bit as great a threat as it did before, if not more, because they've continued to develop nuclear weapons, they've continued to improve their missile system in the interim, and they represent, you know, a dangerous threat not only to that region, not only to South Korea and Japan, but to the United States. So if we're going to engage, and I think, you know, we ought to pursue that as best we can, we better damn well be prepared to make clear what we're asking and what we're asking of them and what they are asking of us.
Have you ever actually been to a summit where there was confetti and balloons?
No.
No. Secretary Mattis, today Secretary Esper, when he was talking to Brett Baer, said that there was a time in 2017 where he thought the U.S. might go to war with North Korea. Was there ever a time when you were Secretary of Defense where you kind of, it hit you and you thought, wow, we may go to war with North Korea? And when was that?
Probably about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
My point is, we've lived with this in the U.S. military for a long time. The Obama administration was very upfront as they were leaving. They warned us this was on the front burner and it was boiling. They were helpful. As they walked us through what they had been doing and what had worked, what had not worked, which was mostly what had not worked. And my first trip as a result was to Tokyo and to Seoul, first trip overseas. I think that every day you had to look at, I was on the screen watching the missiles arc up and you're listening to the soldiers at Fort Wainwright in Alaska and Vandenberg Air Force Base here checking in at the rate of fire, the ships are at sea. You hear the Cheyenne Mountain tracking them, and we're calculating where are they going to go, where are they going to land. You can't stand there like that without a sense that this could be it. So there is an advantage, as Secretary Panetta, as you just said, that when we start talking, at least we stop those missile firings that were going up for the first 8 months I was in office. But then there's, you pointed out about the summit, and you know, ladies and gentlemen, a summit's the top of a mountain. A mountain of work goes into a successful summit. That's why it's called a summit. And we did not perhaps have the alignment of the departments. We had not engaged sufficiently with our allies at times, even to a point of them fearing that they would read something in the newspaper about what was going on. And I bring this up because this didn't work in the last, I heard that in the last administration that we'd done the same thing, making a deal with Iran, and our allies had to read about it in the newspaper because they weren't being briefed. We have got to get back to the way the greatest generation came home from World War II, and a depression, a worldwide depression, a war that cost 60 million dead, a war that Churchill, when asked what to name it, said the unnecessary war. Because had we done our work as allies and aligned ourselves together in the 30s and stopped the fascists then, we need never have gone into that big war. So the greatest generation comes home and said, this is a crummy world, and we're part of it whether we like it or not. So they said, what we're going to have to do is engage. And out of that comes the United Nations, an imperfect way to discuss problems. It was never there to solve all problems. We come up with the Marshall Plan to help the hated Nazi country and the Japanese who had treated our prisoners horribly. We give them a hand up. And we make what a foreign ambassador taught me was the single greatest self-sacrificial pledge in world history. I'm sitting there thinking, what is that? You know, I was having lunch in his backyard in Washington, D.C. And he said, after World War II, you could have said, that's twice in 25 years, Europe, that you drew us into your silly wars. And we're done with it. We're turning to Latin America and Asia for our markets. You're on your own with the Soviet forces. We're through. We're out of here. He said, instead, you pledged 100 million dead Americans in a nuclear war in order to protect democracy in Western Europe. And why do I bring this up now? Because we all thought we were going in to protect Europe, and the first time NATO goes to war is when New York City is attacked. If we ever had to stop and think of the value of allies and why we need to engage with them on Korea, on Iran, on Russia, on China, going it alone in this world doesn't work. And the greatest generation wasn't the greatest just because they whipped fascism. Truman was asked about it by a young graduate student named Henry Kissinger. He said he was proudest as president that we whipped the fascists and then welcomed the Japanese and German people back into the community of nations. That's the America that stands up for values and creates peace and prosperity in the world. You can't do that alone. And right now what we're doing in some cases is we're working without or against allies. I got over enjoying public humiliation by second grade. I didn't like it. And we'd better be careful about humiliating people in the world that we need beside us on dealing with the kind of issues, Courtney, that you're bringing up to us today. Every one of them takes allies.
One of the strongest U.S. military mill-to-mill alliances with the South Koreans. And President Trump this week said that South Korea needs to spend more burden sharing. He said, we think it's fair they pay substantially more because the U.S. military is protecting South Korea. At the same time, this is at the NATO summit this week, he said that Saudi Arabia is paying us billions of dollars and they're happy to do so. What kind of message does that send to allies? And do you worry, Secretary Panetta, that that kind of talk makes the U.S. military look like a bunch of mercenaries?
Well, look, Secretary Gates, Secretary Panetta, when we went to NATO, we made clear that those countries, largely were not meeting their 2% requirement. And he was critical about it. I was critical about it. But pushing them on that front is important. There's no question about it. But the mission is what is important about NATO. The mission is what is important about dealing with South Korea. And the mission involves our national security interests. I mean, the reality is we have 25,000 troops there in South Korea. Why? To protect our national security interests. It's not just to protect South Korea, it's to protect our national security interests. Because North Korea represents a threat not just to South Korea, not just to Japan, but to us. So that's why we're invested there. And by the way, the South Koreans do a pretty damn good job of working with us in providing a strong defense. I mean, they're going to be the first ones on the line, as well as the United States, if North Korea tries to do something. So, do they have to help share the burden? Of course. But the fundamental thing you want to impress on South Korea and Japan is the need to work together to make sure that we have a common front in dealing with North Korea. I mean, Jim is absolutely right. The strength of the United States of America lies in our alliances and our ability to work with others. China hates alliances. Russia hates alliances. Our adversaries don't like alliances. But our ability to work with others and develop those alliances is the key to our ability to be able to protect our national interests. That's what it's about in the end. So, I think I understand, you know, the president's concern about making sure that people pay for things, but he ought to, at the same time, express concern about the importance of the mission for why we're there and what we're trying to do to protect our interests.
Secretary Mattis, you had a good relationship with your South Korean counterpart. You mentioned it was your first overseas trip when you became Secretary of Defense. President Trump has had a very good relationship. He talks frequently about his good relationship with Kim Jong-un. Do you worry that, but despite the diplomacy, North Korea is not denuclearized, they've made very few steps, if any, to actually meet their side of the agreement. Do you think that Kim is playing President Trump with this whole friendship?
Well, I think Kim is playing his own people, he's playing his own army, he's playing everybody. But at the same time, that doesn't mean you don't try and do something to avert the challenge that's coming, that we can all see clearly coming. So it's a matter of using diplomacy, but I would also say that until we get international economic sanctions on them so that it hurts so much that they've got a motivation to do something with us, that they're going to continue playing everyone. I mean, you could say they've played every president that's ever tried to deal with this intractable problem. And we go back to President Clinton and the time they signed during that administration an agreement that he wouldn't develop nuclear weapons. So, I mean, yeah, it's probably a good way to put it. I don't know if he's playing Trump as much as he's playing the entire issue, and Trump is just part of the issue.
You know, the important thing is we can't trust Kim Jong-un, okay? You have to begin with that premise. You don't trust him. No. I mean, you know, the intelligence tells us what this guy is up to. We have a pretty good sense of what he's up to, what makes him tick. I mean, you know, anybody who likes Dennis Rodman, and gets along with Dennis Rodman raises concerns. In addition to that, this is a guy who's now riding a white horse up in the snow and talking about Christmas gift. There's something weird going on here. We ought not to kid ourselves that somehow this is a guy you can kind of love. It's a little dangerous. So understanding that we've got an adversary, understanding that this guy, you know, is going to be very difficult to deal with, as other administrations had to learn, understanding that you can't trust them, understanding that they're going to have to verify every damn thing they do. Mm-hmm. There's a way to get this done, but it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of negotiation and a lot of unity with our allies to be able to do it. Because the bottom line is that, just as we've seen happen over these last 2 years, he's not going to deliver on denuclearization unless there is a set plan that can be enforced to make him do it. And he's not, you know, he is by instincts going to basically take steps to keep churning the water, because he's appealing to his people and he wants to maintain control over his people. The other important ally on this, I think, is one that, you know, we've tried to explore, is China, to try to put additional pressure on. China was concerned about Kim Jong-un and kind of, you know, not bringing China into this. We've lost some leverage in trying to get Kim Jong-un to do the right thing.
There was another question in the Reagan National Defense Survey that kind of deals with that. It's on Hong Kong. And when asked what the U.S. should do about the situation in Hong Kong, the majority of respondents, 68%, said the U.S. should support the pro-democracy movement even if it angers China. Only 14% said decide with the Chinese government. Does the U.S. need to take a stronger stance on China, specifically with respect to their human rights violations?
I think it's important that we stand for human rights. Some of our most successful diplomacy in recent history was under President Reagan, when he and Secretary Shultz tied human rights very tightly to our relations with Russia. They did so by strengthening the military, certainly on our side, so there was no mistake that we would fight if it was necessary. But in all the engagements, they tried to, in their negotiations, to tie human rights stances to some of the things that we knew the Russians wanted or needed. And that way they saw it as a package deal. For example, Secretary Shultz, the Secretary of State, would always meet with dissidents or with Jewish refugees or Jews who wanted to get out to Israel. He would meet with them while he was in Moscow. Mm-hmm. There was no hard line between our foreign policy and human rights. It was integrated into it. And I think we need to continue that tradition.
We're going to take a couple of questions in just a minute, but I want to ask you about a domestic issue, both of you. Secretary of the Navy Richard Spencer resigned, or was forced to resign, several weeks ago. He said in his resignation letter, he said he could not obey an order that violates his oath. To both of you, was Secretary Spencer right or wrong in resigning and in trying to talk the Trump administration, President Trump, into changing his mind?
I don't know all the ins and outs of just exactly what Secretary Spencer tried to do, or who he was talking to, and the communication that was going on within the Pentagon. But I will tell you this, that the strength of our military depends on discipline, and it depends on the importance of those who fight to follow orders. That goes to the heart and soul of the strength of our military. We have the strongest military in the world. We have the finest men and women in uniform fighting for us. But they have to be disciplined. They have to follow orders. When I was in the Army, I was trained to follow orders. That's what soldiers are trained to do, follow orders. They're the greatest fighting machine in the world, but they have to follow orders. That's how you take the hill, is by doing that. And I think it is important not to undermine the disciplinary process within the military, because it's a damn good process. And the commanders understand how important it is. That's why we have the process set up. So that process ought to be allowed to proceed. And I'm afraid when the president did what he did with Gallagher, that he sent a message that, you know, can be dangerous with regards to a military operation. Mm-hmm. Because then you have a bunch of rogue players who decide they can do whatever the hell they want to do. That would undermine, you know, the strength of our military.
Do you agree, Secretary Mattis? I mean, you spent 4 decades in the Marine Corps. You understand discipline.
I wouldn't add anything to what Secretary Panetta said on the need for discipline. We don't need a mob with weapons in their hands who decide to do their own thing. That's not consistent with our military tradition. It's not frankly, it will not defend America. We'll lose. But I know Secretary Spencer. He's an honorable man. When you resign over a matter of principle, that's an intensely personal, ethical decision, and it was his decision and his alone, and I respect him.
I'm gonna take a couple of questions here. If I can figure out how to work this thing. The first question from our audience: even when our interests and values align, for example, in Hong Kong, what should U.S. support for freedom and democracy look like in practice? And I'm going to take the second one at the same time. What are the realistic chances we'll see real change in Hong Kong? Is the CCP's domination of the city a foregone conclusion? If not, what's a realistic way this ends? That was a lot of questions at once. Do you want to write them down?
It is important, going to the very theme of why we're up here on the stage, that the United States has to address human rights issues. I said we have to deal with these countries and our adversaries from strength. One of the ways we reflect that strength is not just through our military, it's not just through our willingness to use military power if we have to. It's not just through our diplomatic efforts. It's through our willingness to stand up for what's right. If we do that with the Chinese, if we do that with the Russians, yeah, they don't like it. You know, I've been in the room when we've raised issues, human rights issues, with leaders around the world. They don't like it. But they also understand that the United States is saying what really is right in terms of how you treat people. And that's what we have to continue to do. Now, you know, with regards to Hong Kong and with regards to what's happening with the Uyghurs, this is terrible. I mean, they're putting these people in camps and thinking that they can somehow brainwash them into changing their beliefs and changing their language. I mean, it's an experiment that's doomed to failure. You know, we've seen that throughout history. It doesn't work. And the situation in Hong Kong is important for us to take a strong position with regards to those in Hong Kong. Yes, you know, we're dealing with China. Yes, we're in trade discussions with China. But that doesn't mean that somehow we surrender what we believe in. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to speak out. I think it's important to try to say, you know, is there an effective way to try to, you know, use our influence to help resolve the issues there? They're tough. But I do think China understands that they too have to be careful about how they handle Hong Kong. I think the Congress did the right thing in its willingness to come forward and pass legislation on these issues. I think that sent an important signal. So I think that plus the results of their election have created at least the opportunity for something better to happen there.
We haven't talked at all about Russia yet, so I'm going to ask something just very broad. Secretary Mattis, how do you deal with someone like Vladimir Putin?
With a lot of vodka. I think what it's like any of these kinds of problems. Number one, you keep NATO strong, and when in doubt, strengthen it some more. That's probably the most important first step in dealing with Putin, because he too is a guy who respects only strength. So the stronger we make NATO, the stronger is our opposition to his mucking around in our elections or other people's elections or making him pay economically for what he's done in Crimea. But I think too, understanding him, we have to start with understanding him. And I was talking to a pretty learned guy, and he said he's a creature out of Dostoevsky. He says he sees Russia surrounded by nightmares. And if you start by understanding that, then he can destabilize all the nations on the near periphery, and somehow he thinks that builds his security. He doesn't see a democracy next door as building his security. Why not? For the same reason the Chinese PRC doesn't see the kids in the streets of Hong Kong and democracy there as building their security. Democracy scares tyrants. And we're just going to have to accept this is something we're going to have to deal with Putin, and deal with the Putin you have, not the one we hoped for back in the 1990s and early 2000s, when we made legitimate efforts to try to work with Russia. And so we're going to have to deal with that. And it's all interrelated, because in Beijing and Moscow, they're watching how we deal with Iran and North Korea. It's not like they're not drawing conclusions from whether we shoot or not when Iran knocks down one of our drones. So we're going to have to get a grand strategy and understanding of our place in the world, what we stand for, what we won't stand for, and live by that. I think that as you look at Hong Kong, for example, you'll keep hearing that, you know, this is an internal matter. No, I don't believe it is an internal matter. In the 1980s, China came to us, PRC came to us and said, will you support us on the return of Hong Kong to China? It's a colonial vestige, and we recognize that. Obviously, it's not connected to the British Isles geographically. And they promised us one country, two systems, and they violated that promise. So this is not an internal matter. This was an international word that they gave us. And if they want to be trusted on anything else, they're going to have to live up to that. So we have every reason to stand up and let them know what we think about what's going on there. I'd be concerned they're just going to let Hong Kong disintegrate and just let it eat itself, say, see, that's what happens with democracy right now.
On the on the Putin question, you know, I think it was President Bush said that he looked into his eyes and saw somebody he could deal with. And I remember Bob Gates saying, I looked into his eyes and I saw KGB, KGB, KGB. And I, you know, I think it's important to understand that Putin, again, you know, this authoritarian figure. It's not to say that Putin isn't somebody that you can deal with. I mean, I think you can deal with Putin, but again, you have to deal with Putin from strength. He's got to know where you're going to draw the lines. He's got to know that there are things he can't do, and that the United States will take steps to do that. But what Putin has done is essentially read weakness into the United States, not just in this administration, several administrations. I think he's read weakness. And he's taking advantage of that weakness. That's why he went into Crimea. That's why he went into the Ukraine. That's why he went into Syria. That's why he conducted the kind of attacks that occurred on our election systems, because he reads weakness in the United States. And that's why, you know, the first step in dealing with Putin is you've got to start drawing lines with regards to his behavior. NATO is a good way to do that, because NATO is the primary alliance to basically say to Russia, you're not going anywhere.
Yep.
You're not going to try to, you know, invade another country the way you tried to do with the Ukraine. We have got to draw those lines, and that needs to be done. Otherwise, make no mistake about it, Putin now reads what's happening in this country as a success to his effort to undermine the United States. He's the one who's benefiting from this. And as long as he thinks he can get away with that, he'll continue to do it. That's the danger.
We're out of time, but I want to ask you each a personal question. Secretary Panetta, can you tell us the story of the most expensive bottle of wine you ever drank, now that you're a winemaker?
it was during the Bin Laden effort that we were conducting. Had found this compound. I think it was in August of that year, and you know, there was a good indication, because it was the couriers, that it might be where Bin Laden was located. So we continued to do surveillance for about a number of months. Anyway, that New Year's, I've got a friend in Monterey who has a restaurant there, Sardine Factory, and he has a New Year's Eve party where we all go into the wine cellar, and you know, we go around, and he got up and he started talking about the great wines that he has in his wine cellar, one of which is a Lafite Rothschild that's worth $15,000. And I said to him, I said, Ted, when are you going to open that damn bottle? And he looked at me and he says, I'll tell you what, I'll open it when you get Bin Laden. And I immediately jumped up and I said, you're on. You're on. So a few months go by, and we conduct the operation on, I think it was May 1st. And after, I went back to my office, and I called my wife, Sylvia, and I said, Sylvia, I said, call up Ted. Tell him to watch television tonight, the president's speech, and then tell him that he owes me a bottle of wine. So Sylvia finally tracked him down. And told him, you got to watch the president. He's going to have an announcement to make. And you know, Leon says, you owe him a bottle of wine. So he did. He watched it. He saw the announcement. He called my wife. He said, the son of a bitch. the son of a bitch set me up. Yeah.
I just want to bet with the Pentagon press corps, because they said I would be the first one to drop a swear word up here, and I said it would be you. Secretary Mattis, you don't escape unharmed either.
Yeah, you're way over, of course.
I know. I'm in television. You don't listen to the stage manager. A friend of yours told me a story about you running away from home as a teenager, and when your mom found out you were running away, rather than try to stop you, she helped you pack your duffel bag. What did she put in the bag?
That didn't happen. She that never happened. Somebody's messing with you.
She never tried to pack some Jane Austen novels for you?
No.
I got a pretty good source on it, Mr. Secretary. Are you a
Jane Austen? I'll see you outside, Cora.
Are you a you don't have a PSD anymore. You can't threaten me. You can't threaten to kill me anymore.
We'll share a bottle.
Yeah. Thank you, Secretary Mattis, Secretary Panetta. Thank you all for being here.